Attention, attention all personnel. It's MASHcast.
Hello and welcome to MASHcast, the show that analyzes and celebrates episode by episode the greatest TV series of all time, MASH, which aired on CBS from 1972 to 1983. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, General Robert Iron Guts Kelly, and joining us this week in the VIP tent is Ensign Jeff Pullier. Hi, Jeff. Welcome to the show.
Hi, General. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you here. This is your debut appearance on MASHcast. Now, of course, everyone that just listened to that intro that knows anything about Army ranks is wondering, Ensign, that's not a thing in the Army. But you specifically asked me to give you that intro. So why don't you explain to everybody why you asked to be a Navy rank and not an Army one?
Well, none of them were officers. Both of my grandfathers and my step-grandfather were all in the Navy in World War II. They were all volunteers.
So if you are on the show again, what would you be, what do you need me to promote you to? If we're going to keep, continue this gag throughout the seasons, what would you be next?
I think the next step up from ensign is lieutenant. And in fact, if anything, if years of watching Star Trek have taught me, yes, the step up from ensign would be lieutenant.
All right. Fair enough. my dad was in the Navy as well. So there's some solidarity there for sons and relatives of Navy men. He served in the Korean War, actually, this one. So anyway, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it. We're here to talk about the season 6 episode, The Merchant of Korea. One of my favorites from this season. It's episode 14 of season 6. It originally aired on December 20th, 1977, right before Christmas. Before we get to the plot synopsis, Jeff, I have to ask you, of course, how did you become a fan of MASH in the first place?
My dad was a huge MASH fan. This is, the same thing you get when you talk to anyone of our age group. Our parents watched MASH, and therefore we did. In most cases, single television families, and therefore if there was a TV show on and your parents let you watch it, you watched it with them. Watched MASH pretty much my entire life. I'm born in 73, so the show's older than I am. Mm-hmm. I do remember the first time I saw the movie version of MASH, which was about 1981, and even edited for TV. It just broke me because it was so bleak compared to what I was used to.
Right. So you were comparing it to what the show, you've been watching the show all that time,
yeah,
right?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
So it's pretty rough.
And then eventually, thanks to garage sales and used bookstores, I had all of the MASH novels. Now, of course, listeners to this show probably already know MASH started as a novel. And then there was one really good sequel, and then there were a bunch of terrible sequels that weren't even actually written by the original author. And then finally, there was one more good book backed by the original author. And at this point, I only own the three good ones. I got rid of all the others.
All right. Okay. I'm gonna take some issue with there being good ones, because I didn't think any of them were particularly good. I would argue that I think kind of like we were talking about with the movie. I find the books just so different than what I'm used to that I just find them kind of like, oh God, I can't. Well,
the movie is really an excellent adaptation of the first book. There's very little changed between the original book and what Bob Altman did as a movie. Although, interestingly enough, there is almost no mention of Korea in the entire movie because Bob Altman really wanted the audience to think of it as Vietnam,
right?
Not as Korea.
Right. It mentions Korea like right in that opening crawl.
Yeah, exactly. Right
the, and then almost never again in the exactly. course of 2 hours. So, okay. So, okay. Well, you said you watched the show with your parents. And I mean, I did that too. There was a lot of TV that I watched it because my parents watched it. But obviously, you've continued on to be a fan. So what was it about the show? Why is it so resonant to you even, four decades later?
For the same reason, I'm more of a Marvel Comics fan than a DC Comics fan. They were flawed heroes. You don't have a Clark Kent or a Barry Allen in MASH. You have Peter Parker and Ben Grimm kind of characters. Hawkeye Pierce is my hero, but there are things about him that are not good. I mean, you know, it's dealt with a bit. His alcoholism was kind of brushed under the table, in my opinion. You know, and he's certainly a womanizer. He definitely has flaws, but he's still the hero of the story. And so much of my morality comes in line with Hawkeye Pierce. My stance on war and on weapons in general, my stance on treating people as equals unless they prove themselves to be a terrible jerk. judging someone by their character, not by the color of their skin or where they're from. And, you know, there's certainly other influences in that, but Hawkeye Pierce is a huge one for me.
That's interesting. I've never heard anybody make the comparison to MASH to Marvel specifically. But yeah, I mean, as a longtime comic book fan, yeah, that was the big innovation that Stan Lee kind of brought to comics in the 60s was our flawed heroes. And yeah, Hawkeye Pierce would fit in quite well in the sort of Marvel universe in terms of his persona rather than DC. He would not. They're all the Doctor characters in the DC universe are fine, upstanding, perfect, godlike people. You know,
yes.
They're not Stephen Strange and things like that. So. Okay, well, that's really interesting. So do you have, since you're coming on the show, you know, with season six, do you have a general favorite era from the show? Do you have a couple of years that you tend to just like a little more than the others?
I'm going to say the middle Winchester era. So getting into like season 7, 8, 9, there's things to admire in every single year. But the show, and as you've talked about over these past few years, the show changed so much over time. It's almost a completely different show by the time you get to Goodbye, Farewell, and Amen than you had in the pilot. In some cases, like for the Mulcahy, it really is a different show.
Yeah, we'll get to it when we get to it in another 120 episodes. But you think about it, if you had plucked some of the characters from the pilot or even the first season and drop them into Goodbye, Farewell, and Amen, it would just be, what? You know, it would, to talk in comic book lingo, it would be like mixing like DC and Marvel or Earth, One, Earth Two. It would just be so different
The episode we're talking about today, the major Houlihan in this episode is almost completely different than the Hot Lips in episode one.
Oh, completely. Completely. Yeah. And I said this, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, I love this episode. This is one of my favorite episodes from season six. So let's get to it. As I said, it's called The Merchant of Korea. It was written by Ken Levine and David Isaacs. Of course, Ken was on the show last season and was directed by William Jurgensen. So BJ gets a telegram from his wife, Peg, telling him that they have a chance to buy a piece of property that they've had their eye on for a long time, if he can come up with a $200 down payment in the next 24 hours. BJ asks around, but both Hawkeye and Radar are pretty much broke. In desperation, he turns to the richest guy he knows, his fellow swamp rat, Winchester. Winchester gives him the money, but soon after he starts to treat BJ like a $200 houseboy, asking him for small favor after small favor. Things get worse when payday, which was scheduled to be the next day, is delayed when the 477's money is accidentally sent to Guam. This keeps BJ indebted to Winchester and leaves everyone in the camp broke, except for Winchester, of course. And when he pays Hawkeye's bar tab in the officers' club, he starts treating Hawkeye in the same do-me-a-small-favor manner. This drives them both to distraction, and they come up with the idea to have a poker game and invite Winchester, who knows nothing of the game, to play, intending to rob him blind. News of the game spreads, and with the idea of Winchester sitting in, everyone joins in. At first, Winchester acts uncertain and hesitant, which causes everyone else to bet heavily. But the joke's on them when Winchester wins the first hand, drawing a straight out of a four-card draw. This continues all night with Winchester winning hand after hand. First the war, now this, Hawkeye offers, leaving everyone else off more broke than they were before. In the middle of the night, Winchester asks for a break and takes a walk outside. Back inside the Oak Club, everyone marvels at how Winchester is winning so much. They then notice that Winchester has a tell. He whistles loudly when he's bluffing. With this piece of info, they commence playing, and when Winchester starts whistling loudly again, everyone antes up confidently. Morning arrives, and Winchester is cleaned out. He's fronted money for the last hand by Hawkeye and BJ after they both paid off the money they owe him over the course of the night. He loses that hand too, officially ending the marathon session. As everyone clears out, Hawkeye and BJ goof on Winchester for losing so much, but he takes it all in stride, boasting he spent more money than this on a late night snack at home. Since he now owes them money, Hawkeye and BJ guilt Winchester into sticking around and cleaning up the O Club, which he does, whistling opera the whole time. All right, Jeff, again, we're going to go through it beat by beat, but overall, what is your feeling about this episode?
This is a very lighthearted episode. There's no great tragedy. There's barely a moral lesson, even. It is just a lighthearted comedy, which is especially amusing when you consider that the title is a play off Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice, which is very much a tragedy. The only similarities between the two is that you have someone with money lending it to someone who needs it desperately. That's where the similarities begin and end.
Yeah, there is no medicine in this episode. None. You know, they are
in OR just briefly.
Right, right.
Because Charles asks BJ to finish up for him, which is definitely against procedure. That's one of his little favors, but that's it.
Right. But I mean, there's no patience. I shouldn't say there's no medicine. I mean, there is that scene, but yeah, there's no medical problem to deal with other than, again, just them sort of working on the wounded soldiers briefly. And we get a scene where Winchester talks about a particular family that moved in close to them. We'll talk about that when we get to it. But yeah, I absolutely love the show. It's like MASH Olympics. It's lighthearted. It's a character piece. I think it's nice that Winchester gets an episode to it. Not that this is the first episode he's gotten to himself in season six, of course. There's the Winchester tapes and Change Day. But I like that he's integrated more with the camp. We get to learn more about him, but it's just lighthearted. You know, as I've said, every time they've done an episode where they were playing cards, I could watch these guys play cards all day. You know, deal Me Out from season two is one of my all time favorite episodes. It's like if they had just wanted to do one of these every season of just them playing cards and just BSing around for 24 minutes, I would have been satisfied. So I absolutely love it. And I appreciate Ken Levine being willing to do it. He's talked about it on his podcast, and he's done it on when he had his blog going, that the writers hated coming up with and directors hated poker episodes. Because they're hard to shoot, because you have to kind of keep the audience involved in the stakes of the game, but that's hard. And continuity wise, it's hard to keep together because you have to kind of, you know the ins and outs of the game of poker. And so, yeah, we see them play poker here and we see some hands, but generally we only kind of see the conclusion of any given hand of who's won and who hasn't. But
at any given time, you can only see the faces of about half the cast.
Right.
Because they're seated around a table.
Which is another nice little touch, of course. Because generally we don't put the backs of our characters to the audience. That's usually never a thing. But they do that here. So yeah, I just absolutely love this episode. And the lightheartedness, I think, starts right at the very beginning where we're seeing Hawkeye and BJ, and they've kind of opened up the swamp, the side of the swamp, in a way we've kind of never seen them do before. And they've kind of turned it into like a porch that they've got on the side of the swamp. But it opens with this great jazzy music, like this sort of like da, 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 da. And it, to me, it sets the tone. Yeah. It sets the tone of like, okay, this is going to be a fun interactive episode. And it's not going to be the kind of heavy stuff that we're dealing with. And again, I love that little bit of like, da, 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 da. And Radar runs in and he explains why he's coming in. And he hands off this, I love, he hands this note and, the first great joke of the line where BJ says it's in Korean.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Radar's like, no, that's just my handwriting.
And BJ was even holding the note the wrong direction.
That's Radar, right. Yeah. It's upside
Radar
down.
Radar turns it 90 degrees to actually read it.
It's great. I wish they had done this more of where they lift up the tent flap and they've created like their own little balcony for it. I just think that's really funny. I just love that visual. BJ asks for the note that he gets, and we find out that, okay, it's a telegram from Mrs. Honeycutt, and that there's this real estate deal that they want to close, in the Stinson Beach, as they refer to it, which is a suburb outside of San Francisco. And of course, because the mail is so slow, or not the mail, but the telegrams kind of come in, I guess, a little slow, that BJ is just hearing about it the day of, which means they've got to get the money over there immediately. And so, bang, we've already got our you know, we're about 30 seconds into the show, and we've got our plot for the entire, you know, the run of this episode.
One small continuity problem there, though, or a real-life problem, if you will. It's the 15th where they are in Korea.
Mm-hmm.
In San Francisco, as the episode's taking place, it's still the 14th.
I guess it would be, wouldn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. Now, BJ still needs to hurry because I'm sure transfers take time, but it's not the actual same day as they try and make us think. Or more likely, they just didn't think about it.
I never thought about that, but you're right. Yeah, because they're like plus 18 hours or whatever it is.
Something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. But of course, BJ doesn't have the money, and he turns to his pals, and Hawkeye says he spent all his money on the subscription to the nudie magazine, say 50 cents off the newsstand price. I like that he points to Radar like that's like a tip that he keeps offering Radar, and Radar's, you know, which I think is great. And BJ has the line, damn, somebody else will buy that land to put up a shopping center. And of course, enter Winchester. Speaking of that somebody, BJ has to gently try and suggest, maybe you could borrow, he's kind of getting to it. And Hawkeye just jumps to it. He's like, Charles, BJ needs $200. Lend him some, will you?
Oh, yeah. Hawkeye is not beating around the bush. Subtle, he is not.
No. I did notice, though, you know what? You know, take it back. I shouldn't say I noticed it. I noticed it on IMDb, and then I watched it, and it's true. There is a very brief, and this is so rare on MASH that's even worth pointing out. There, in this scene, this opening scene, there is a error on the part of one of our actors, and that is Mike Farrell, in that when they are talking to Radar about the booze, the incredibly strong martinis they're making, the line is, you sip it through a fuse. And both Hawkeye and BJ start saying the line. And then halfway through the phrase, Mike Farrell stops talking because it's clearly Hawkeye's line. But they left it in. And I've never noticed that. 10,000 times I've watched this episode, I've never caught it. And it was only because somebody mentioned it on IMDb. And then you see it. Once you see it, you're like, oh, yeah. BJ starts to talk and then he stops.
I'm guessing they must have just been pressed for time. Or they could have re-recorded that. You know, it's a really short bit. It would not have taken that much to redo. But they, you know, they must have been up against deadlines of some kind that made it not worth going back.
I guess so. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure they noticed it. I mean, at the very least, your Mike Farrell might have been like, yeah, wait a minute, hold on.
I'm sure he would have said something.
But it goes by, again, I've seen this episode, for 40 years, I've never noticed it. And it's only because of that eagle-eyed IMDb person mentioned it. So, and once you see it, it's like, oh, that's fun. Cause you just very rarely see these actors ever. And it's not even like a mistake, really. You know what I mean? Like it's not a continuity mistake. Yes, we know it's a mistake because the actors don't have the same line, but it's not like Mike Farrell referred to Hawkeye as Alan, you know, which would be a mistake. You know, you could be like, oh, that's obviously a mistake. It's a flub. They both started saying something and then one of them stopped. So, okay.
Whatever. Yeah. Mike Farrell just walked on the line a little bit. And when you're memorizing a new script every single week, it's amazing. We don't see more of these kind of problems.
Seriously. Yeah. I couldn't do it. I tried a little bit for the last year and before that, the year or two before that, I was doing these videos on our network YouTube page where I was doing movie trailer commentaries and I recorded an intro, and because I don't want to be reading off a script, I'm looking in the camera and I had to memorize it, and I'm doing my own writing. I wrote maybe 10 lines to get the intro, and I can't tell how many takes it took me to do it, and I got so frustrated. You know, I'm like, son of a, and I would get right to the end and then flub one word at the end and everything. So yeah, I have such respect for these actors that can memorize this amount of material this fast, like soap opera actors and stuff. It's unreal how much effort it takes to get all this right. So anyway, Winchester, of course, offers him the money. And he says, you know, you're not, it's not like you can go anywhere. BJ hands the money to Radar, and they take off. Oh, by the way, I should mention that line we just talked about. It's not to Radar, it's to Winchester. They sip it, you sip it through a fuse. Mm-hmm. That's the bit where it happens there. I love that Winchester turns it down. He says, I make a point not to drink anything that's been aged in a radiator. And Hawkeye says, he knows what he's missing. And yeah. Winchester yeah. laughs. I love those. I will point it out every time. I love it when Winchester laughs at a Hawkeye joke, because it's like, okay. Yeah, well, yes, Winchester looks down on Hawkeye. He thinks he's an idiot. Maybe not an idiot, but he certainly thinks he's a moral reprobate. But he still can laugh at Hawkeye's jokes sometimes. I love all this.
Well, Hawkeye is kind of putting himself down there, so of course Charles would find it funny.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I absolutely love it. So now I will say this episode, I mean, there's a greater piece of it at the end, but this episode, I've mentioned this in other shows, my fascination since I was a child with the San Francisco area, California in general, but the San Francisco area, the Bay Area particularly, mm-hmm. it is almost entirely thanks to BJ Honeycutt being from this area. That, you know, that was the and then when, between that and Star Trek IV, those are the two that made me be like, oh, I want to go live outside San Francisco. But it really is BJ.
You didn't also watch The Streets of San Francisco when growing up?
No, I did not watch that show. Okay. That was kind of off my radar, no pun intended, at the time. But and so BJ would mention a bunch of times, but if we're going to narrow it down even further, it's this episode. It's this one, because BJ's going on and on and on about how much this little area is like heaven's got trees, the beach, like he's going on and on about it. And again, the whole episode is about them getting this little parcel of land that BJ can't even enjoy right now. He mm-hmm. might not be able to enjoy it. And there's no house there. They have to build on it. Like they literally just buying a piece of land. But this episode really began my fascination with that part of this country. And I've been there since. I've been there when we went there on my honeymoon. So like, and we drove through Mill Valley. And I took a picture of the sign, and I even sent it to Mike Farrell, and God bless him. He's nice enough to say, oh, that's great, as opposed to leave me alone, you weirdo. Like, he's really nice about it. But it really is this episode that started all that. So we are in surgery, and we talk about how hot it is, and we see everybody is sweating. Winchester starts talking about they talk about the making plans for later, and then Winchester talks about, he says, can I trouble you for a consultation, which is, you know, you got to figure something's up, because Winchester doesn't ask anybody for advice, you know.
No.
And this is all a blind, and then he finally gets BJ to help him out, and he says, you're moving up to real estate, huh? And he's, yes, Stinson's Beach is not real estate, it's heaven with a view. And then Winchester goes on this little side story about this property that his father owned in Hyannisport. And he says, this large family moved in next door. Nouveau Riche played a perpetual game of touch football on their lawn. Naturally, we moved out.
Now, I wonder who he could possibly,
we all know who they're talking about. But it's kind of funny in that this is a fairly atypical MASH joke, because MASH generally did not make jokes to where the payoff was the audience is ahead of the characters. They didn't really do jokes like that. The show basically made jokes within the context of the time that it takes place in. But here, you know, we're all supposed to know, okay, he's talking about the Kennedys, obviously. But the show generally didn't do stuff like that. So it's kind of an unusual joke of that. It's the audience kind of going, okay, we know who they are, because they've since become famous. Post, you know, when this show, not the Joseph Kennedy was already known at that point, but nevertheless, mm-hmm. and, you know, whatever. But I just find it's unusual. It's an unusual joke. And I will say this scene, that little speech was always cut in the syndicated episode that I watched at home. It was only until the DVDs that it was put back in. And I'm like, oh, wow, this is a whole bit. He's talking about the Kennedys here.
I actually would not have known it if it wasn't for the IMDb trivia. I had no idea the Kennedys ever lived in that area.
Yeah. I knew it from the touch football, because I remember seeing games of them playing of JFK playing football on the lawn.
Of JFK, Jack and Bobby playing football that part's famous, but I would not have put it together just from that.
Yeah. So, of course, Winchester finds them to be, you know, intolerable. So we had to move out. he asks BJ to close for him. And because he says he's got duty and he wants to grab a quick bite. And BJ's like, that's not normally how we do things. But he's like, well, you know, okay. And he kind of leans on BJ and BJ goes ahead and does it. This is another one of those things where it's never been explained how things really are done at MASH. Exactly. Like, we're never really like, mm-hmm. I mean, is there somebody paying attention to all this? Is there somebody jotting all this down? Because presumably they have to have some way of keeping tabs on what doctors are doing what. But if, like, is there somebody that, like, sitting in the corner of the OR, you know, going, well, this is like 80% of Winchester patient and 20% of BJ. But like, how do they keep track of all that?
Well, I imagine that the doctors do have to write some kind of report. It's certainly medical notes after each patient. And so this particular patient, most of the report would be by Charles, but there would, you know, probably be some kind of notation that Captain Honeycutt closed.
I guess. Yeah. I mean, again, they're keeping track of these things, but I don't know how you, so BJ's line again, he's like, well, that's not normally how we do things. Well, how is it that we do things here at MASH? We've been watching the show for 11 seasons. I still don't really know how it all works, but okay. So then we cut to, they're in the swamp and BJ is going on and on about where this rock is. That's where the living room's going to be. And he's showing Winchester. BJ he grabs the photo and he's ready to show Hawkeye. Hawkeye's like, no, I don't want to look at your property. I think the only other thing Hawkeye is more sick of hearing about from BJ is Aaron.
Yeah.
He gets tired of the Aaron stories.
I hear about your baby girl.
BJ starts to leave. Winchester asks BJ for a cup of coffee and he's like, well, go get it. No, my back is hurting. Well, if you're going to feel that way about it. And again, he's realizing that he is treating BJ like a, you know, like a houseboy. Mm-hmm. We find BJ and he walks outside and we find Hawkeye. And all Hawkeye is doing is hosing down some of the nurses. He's hosing down Gwen and Nurse Kelly. I love this detail. I love that it's not explained. It's just, this is just something that they're doing when it's this hot where Hawkeye's just spraying water on him.
Well, when Hawkeye gets busy, he turns over the hose to someone else.
He does.
So they can keep hosing the nurses.
I love it. I love that it's just this little slice of life of, like, this is what they have to do with the fourth episode. Now, it seems kind of like a waste of water, which I would think would be at a premium here at the 477th, that you would just hose two of the nurses down. But okay, whatever. It's fine. But I just, I don't know. I just love that Hawkeye does that for them. I just think it's really sweet. So,
we hadn't mentioned, but the only character who's not a regular and gets the line is Zale. And he's at least an irregular. Neither of the nurses have lines. There's no patients that have lines. This was, you could call this a bottle episode. There's absolutely no new sets. There's absolutely no new locations.
No guest cast, yeah.
There's no guest cast. Even the recurring characters, some of them don't have lines, which I would presume means they got paid a lower rate than they normally would for Nurse Kelly and Gwen.
Yeah, so, I don't know how that works. Yeah, I think and you have to get a minimum of lines or something.
I think this episode was really done on the cheap. And considering the previous two-parter was anything but a bottle episode, they probably were looking to cut some costs from the budget for the season. And this episode was a really good way to do that.
Sure, yeah. I mean, I've heard of that, of producers look at the season of TV they've got in front of them and they learn how to budget it and say, well, okay, this episode is going to be real expensive. And as you pointed out, the Comrades in Arms two-parter features a lot of different sets, a lot of guest actors. So yeah, it would make sense to, like, okay, we're going to write a couple that are a lot more simple. And this is one of them. I remember reading that about Game of Thrones, you know, where they knew that at the end of every season, they'd have big action finales. So they would allocate certain resources a certain way, and then they would do other episodes where it's like, all right, it's everybody just inside these dark rooms talking, you know? So yeah, it's good producing. I mean, that's how you figure it. And if you're skilled enough, and of course the MASH people are, you don't notice it. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't think about it. You're not watching this episode going, geez, this is kind of a small episode. You didn't even think about it because it's funny.
Yeah, I certainly didn't think about it as a kid, but watching it as a 50-year-old man, I'm going, oh, yeah, this episode was really done on the cheap. You know, I'm not saying they skimped on the story. It's still a good story. It's enjoyable. It's not epic or anything, but it's an enjoyable story. But it was definitely done dirt cheap.
Yeah, the stakes are low, and as you say, it's the same sets. You know, it's the OR, I mean, they're not the swamp, even, the mess tent. Yeah.
You don't even have anyone throwing anything and breaking it.
All right, everybody. You know, everybody, let's keep this. So let's dig out the old the poker set. That's about the only, you know, prop that we need outside of the standard stuff. So Hawkeye and BJ talk about how annoying Winchester's being, that he's treating BJ again like he's like a $200 houseboy. And of course Hawkeye counsels wisdom and is like, what do you care? You know, who care? You know, we're gonna get paid tomorrow. What's the difference? Let him treat you this way. You're the one with the little slice of heaven. And BJ's like, well, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. we go into the mess tent, and Potter and Margaret are talking about that they're, you know, that the pay is coming in the next day. Oh, Mark, go ahead.
Going into the mess tent is a funny part though. When, in a snooty voice, Hawkeye asks BJ to open the door for him, and BJ says, but of course, opens the door, goes in, and then just lets it slam shut behind him, leaving Hawkeye outside.
Thank you. But of course, yeah, he's doing the kind of haughty British voice. Like I said, we see Potter and Margaret talking about payday. Margaret mentions that she sends all of her pay to Donald, and then he sends a portion of it back, and Potter goes, that's a swell system. And I'm like, is it? It's not. It's a kind of a terrible system. I don't understand. She's a grown woman. Let her keep whatever. What? Like,
well, if they had a household together and needed to balance a household budget, then maybe, but they don't. Not even remotely. It makes no sense. It is a terrible plan. She's being used.
Plus, it just doesn't, like, okay, every pay period, I'm going to get X amount of dollars. I will keep that, and I'll send the rest. Like, why would you do the thing where you're sending it and then sending it back in 1950? Like, that probably had to take forever. Like, to move all that around, it just seems very complicated. It seems very much like Donald is treating Margaret like she is a child and she's getting an allowance. And, you know, we know that that's probably how Penobscot thinks of her, especially, you know, we know that some of these episodes were filmed out of order and shown in a different order than they were produced. I don't buy that Margaret would still be in on this system after the whole bit and Comrades in Arms. Well, that what we've learned also, about Penobscot.
I don't think he's treating her like a child. I think he's manipulating her and making sure she realizes he has the power, which he only has the power in the relationship if she lets him have
it. Right, she gives it to him, yeah.
Yeah, and so I don't think it's a parent-child kind of thing. I think it's just straight up a power play. His machismo doesn't want her to have the freedom and authority that she's used to as a colonel, not enlisted, a career officer in the United States Army. She's not a colonel.
She's a major, yeah.
That. Yeah, major. But still, I mean, that's admirable. She has been driven and determined. She's been at this for a long time. She has authority. And he feels threatened. So in order to put her down in a subtle way, he's controlling her finances. Yeah. That only works while she lets it happen.
Yeah, it's a terrible system. It's just a terrible, terrible system. they talk about that the reason they're doing this is because they want to save up money to buy a house back in America when the war is over. Potter sort of, Deanne, he says, well, we bought our house. We got our house. When we got ours, it came with a mother-in-law. Fortunately for me, World War I started the next day.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Didn't Colonel Potter
not get into the continuity problems there?
Didn't Colonel Potter say on his first episode that he signed up to fight in World War One when he was 15 because he had, and he got away with it because he had big thighs for a boy?
People got married younger in those days.
Yeah,
no wonder the house came with a mother-in-law.
Maybe so.
Mrs. Potter was also probably 15.
It's okay. All right. Whatever. So, word of the card game is now happening. Sangmu, they're talking about this local merchant is obviously coming in, and they're very exciting. And Klinger is like, I'm going to get a strand of pearls. And Potter says he wants to get a blanket for Sophie. Radar comes in with the bad news that the money has been sent to a bakery in Guam, which is fantastic. Like the most possible, the biggest possible mistake you could make, which would be how do you send something to Guam that you're supposed to send to Korea? But, you know, okay, whatever.
Welcome to the United States Army.
I guess so. And so everyone is all groaning and whatever. And Winchester Potter says, okay, take the money, pool it, and pay off the enlisted men until the well runs dry, which of course brings cheers from all the enlisted men. Margaret gets mad. She starts screaming.
Don't yell at the bird.
Yeah. What about the officers? SOP major. And she says, to hell with regulations. and then Potter has the line, oh, major, don't yell at my bird. I love that he has to every so often be like, go, settle down a little bit.
Well, she probably still has memories of Henry Blake, who she could just dump all over.
Probably, yes. I'll go over your head again, you know, all that kind of stuff. But yeah, Potter's not having it. So we then cut to Radar's office where Margaret is talking to Donald, and she's demanding, you know, hey, send some of the money back. It's not my fault that the money's not getting. And he says, cash in some of our savings bonds. So we get this. We don't hear Winchester. Why did I stop doing that? We don't hear Penobscot, but we can figure out that, you know, he's, as you're kind of, you just said this earlier, that he is doing this as a power trip. He's acting as though like all their money's gone and it's all in savings bonds, which we know is probably complete nonsense.
Well, no, he's probably using it to party with other nurses.
Darlene, yeah, he's spending money on Darlene or whatever it is. Yeah, you know, which is ridiculous. I mean, just absolutely ridiculous that he says no. And then Loretta Swit, with her great screaming voice, does that, you know, like she gets what she
don't
gets.
Don't you hang up on me.
And she screamed, you know, and we have Potter saying, love's a wonderful thing, son. And so she's so bad. And, you know, Potter says, why don't you hold back a few dollars from your pay? And she's from now on, I will, which is, yes, that's what you should have been doing in the first place. And then he says, advice is cheap. So is Colonel Donald. Which Radar almost gets him in trouble, and she says twerp, by the way, and runs out the door. Potter then has to mention that there's a great line of business that guy's married to a live grenade, and Radar says he's lucky he's in Tokyo out of range.
Yes.
Great. Potter wants to send a telegram to Mrs. Potter because he needs some money, and Radar has the thing, he says, oh, I could lend you some money. And he says, oh, that wouldn't be proper, Radar. I'd have to pay you would have to pay back. And Ritter's like, darn, you better believe it. Yeah. I'm kind of intrigued at the idea that, like, even Colonel Potter, like, doesn't have extra money lying around. Like, does he, like, when he gets paid, does he spend it all? I would think they'd hold some of it back, but I don't know.
Probably normally sends most of it to Mrs. Potter, but because he wants to spend some at the merchant, he does need a little cash on hand this time.
I guess so. So then we are in the O Club, and we see, as you mentioned, Sergeant Zale, our only kind of bonus character of the episode, who actually says something. He's running the bar, and Winchester is there reading a book, and he's actually got the music turned off because he likes the peace and quiet. Hawkeye orders a drink, but he finds out that his tab is $50. When the limit is supposed to be 20. Now, you got to think about these drinks, right? In 1951, 52, they're like 10 cents, 20 cents. How many drinks? You know, that's a lot of drinking. to get up to 50 bucks.
Let me do the conversion for you, because since money is such an important part of this episode, I looked up the conversion rate, 1952 to today. So a dollar in 1952 is the equivalent of $11.39 today. So $50 in 1952 would be $569.50 today.
Woo!
That is one hell of a bar tab. That's also what Colonel Potter plans to spend on Sophie's blanket. That is one
really?
Hell of a blanket. Yes.
Oh, I missed that. That it's that much. Wow. Yeah, that's a really nice blanket. My goodness.
I would hope so.
Yeah, geez.
That thing better have a really high thread count.
And then they also do the running gag where everyone is sweating uncontrollably because it's so hot. And Winchester says, first of all, it's perspiring. And second of all, I don't perspire. And so we say he's always looking cool. And everyone else is walking around in undershirts and T-shirts. And Winchester's got his full kind of uniform on. In fact, when he comes into the swamp later on in the part two of the episode, he's in his full lab coat and his uniform. And so everyone else, again, he's sweating uncontrollably, but Winchester is not. And so he pays Hawkeye's bar tab. He pays it for him. And Winchester even ends with saying, could you bring me a beer? You know, later on back at the swamp. And Hawkeye really sees that he has now also become morally indebted to Winchester. I don't know. I wouldn't let this bother me. I don't think. I think I would just be like, well, this Winchester's going to be Winchester. I'll bring him a beer, whatever. I would just ignore it. But, you know, I guess maybe living with the guy and just being so superior. It's
well, also, I think it's because at that point he's heard the horror stories from BJ about how Winchester's been abusing his indebtedness, BJ's indebtedness to him, and now Hawkeye is in a smaller boat, but a similar boat, and doesn't like the direction that's going.
No. And of course, Winchester makes it worse when Hawkeye hands him the beer, and he grabs it, and he goes, a little warm. He's like, what's he supposed to do? Whatever they, you know, I mean, I guess they could put it in the meat locker. Where they keep the food, but I mean, you know, come on. So they talk to Winchester and they talk about the card game and they realize Winchester has never played cards. And he says, well, they're playing something else here. Okay. But he decides they talk him into it and they realize, okay, he's going to be the Rube of the game. And they go around and this is, you know, kind of like a caper episode where they go and they tell all the characters. Hawkeye tells Klinger that Winchester is involved. I love Klinger's reaction. Where he's like, look, I, you know, I don't have any money. I can't do it. But Winchester's in, ooh, I'm ready. You know, like he gets super excited. He's totally ready to do it.
I love that we see Klinger's devotion to Hawkeye, because Hawkeye's never been anything but great to Klinger.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he asks Klinger for a favor. I'll give you the blouse off my back.
It's sweet, isn't it?
Which is, you know, is a funny line, but also it's really sweet because Klinger really respects Hawkeye. You know, Hawkeye's not going to get him out of the army, but he never treats him like a degenerate. You know, Hawkeye doesn't want to be there really any more than Klinger does, and Klinger knows that. So, yeah, I love the respect Klinger shows him.
Yeah, it's sweet. It really is. It's a nice show. Like he says, like, can you make some you know, devotion to the underprivileged? You know, he's like, you know, what do you mean, you or whatever? So they round up everybody. They round up Margaret. They round up Mulcahy.
Yeah, Father Mulcahy.
Yeah, right. He really shouldn't kind of be in on this, right? I mean, it's not. It's a little dishonest because they're setting Winchester up to be the pigeon, but Winchester's doing it under his own volition. He's an egregious grown man. You know, I mean, they're not cheating. They just figure he won't be good at playing cards. Well, okay. I mean, that's his choice. I mean, it's a little shady, but it's not that duplicitous, really.
Well, also, I think, you know, if not the exact same thing BJ is going through, Winchester has annoyed everyone in some way.
Yes.
Even to the point where Father Mulcahy wouldn't mind putting him down a peg or two.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
When even the priest is out to get you, you might want to rethink some of your life choices.
So they set up the card game in the O Club. In the foreground, there's this gigantic pile of sandwiches. And I'm always like, who made the sandwich? Like who made those? Like somebody, did they like tap Igor to like, hey, we need to cater the card game. So make some, or do they have the sandwiches? I don't know. I'm just fascinated by this ridiculous minutia.
Jeff Maxwell made the sandwiches, but wasn't allowed to appear.
I guess so. Yeah. yeah. Again, it's just interesting that there's like 30 sandwiches piled up. Like, okay, great. So they start playing. And of course, everyone, you know, Winchester is playing hesitantly and he's like, oh, I'm in for 10, you know, and he asks for four cards on a draw, which of course is the indication that, you know, that you've got a bad hand when you've only got one card worth keeping. And he's, as we know now, he's suckering them in. And he's purposely playing like he's a noob, like at one point where he throws in $2 and he kind of like looks around and he makes like this big gesture of like, oh, yeah, OK. And he even says, and he bets again and he's like, oh, yeah, is this OK? Like he's suckering them in. And then they talk about that BJ always wins the first hand. And he says, until tonight, I believe a straight beats three kings. And there, whammo. Four card draw and he gets a straight. Now, Winchester, he got the cards. He got a lucky hand. Again, he's not cheating, but he obviously knows a lot more about this game than he lets on.
Well, and it shows that he was right, though. He could be very lucky.
Mm-hmm. So we cut to them. Some time has gone by, and they've been playing, and we see that Winchester has keeps winning. Hawkeye has the absolutely fantastic joke, first the ward, now this, which is just, it makes me laugh every single time. And we see that he's basically cleaned everybody out. Father Mulcahy decides to beg off, and Winchester says, here, give this to the orphans. And he hands him like a poker chip, like a single chip, which is probably like a dollar or something like that or whatever it is. And when Mulcahy holds it like, oh, yeah. Thank you. Okay.
Thanks,
yeah,
great gesture.
Yeah. Thanks a bundle. And so they continue to play and Winchester wins again. He piles all his money and he brings like a lockbox with him, which is very funny because it's like he doesn't trust them or something to not steal his money, but he actually puts it all in a metal box and walks out into the compound with it. It's, you know, incredibly disrespectful.
Walks out whistling.
Yes. And so they're all sitting there frustrated and it's that damn smugness. And it's Margaret starts whistling La Traviata, that insipid whistling coming out at an insipid face. And Radar says he can't even stop when he's got a pan in. It keeps whistling louder when he's got nothing. And then it dawns on almost all of them.
Everyone except Radar.
Except for Radar. He's the one looking around like, what? And then they have to tap him and be like, he's whistling louder when he's got nothing. And so they realize that Winchester has a tell. Now that's a thing, I guess. Like in for playing cards or whatever. There's a tell.
It can be. So you know, it can be something as you know, probably not usually something as obvious as whistling louder. But a lot of it has to do with like micro expressions, things people do that they don't realize they do under certain circumstances. And by watching those micro expressions, you can anticipate what's going on through their mind.
I wonder what the psychology is in that, because it's on some level your body is betraying you, I guess.
Exactly.
Because you're revealing something you don't want to be revealed.
Yeah, it's so ordinary to you, you don't even realize that you do it. And so you get in a situation like this where again, you don't know you're doing it. But it can stand out to someone who's watching for something like that.
Yeah, I guess so. I've hardly ever played cards, so I don't know if I ever would experience such a thing. I'll never know at this point. But yeah, it's interesting that he's got this towel. There's a great gag about where they're frustrated about that he doesn't sweat. I've never seen anybody who doesn't sweat. BJ's like, sure you have, in the reptile house, which is great. Another fantastic line. So they realize, okay, now they know his tell. They go and they round up Mulcahy, and Will Mulcahy's like, look, I heard this $30 ago, you know, and then $60 ago. Yeah, there you go. Add the zero. So I heard this $60 ago, and then they said, we have a new scouting report, and he whistles when he's got nothing. Oh, okay. So he gets
whistles back, louder.
Whistles louder when he gets something. So they get, oh, okay. And they get him back. They get him back. We cut to the next morning. We see that Winchester has, of course, been losing all night. He is, in fact, sweating.
Profusely.
I love this thing where he says, you know, he's out of money and he says, you know, I was nice enough to give you guys some money. And so they each, BJ and Hawkeye each give money. He says, you're going to regret your generosity. I raise you 30. I like that his tone changes. Like he's all gentle. I raise you 30. And then he starts whistling and they realize, okay, they all know to bet and they beat him. They clean him out. And everyone has a good laugh, and we see that obviously everybody has, on some level, won some percentage across the night, and they've all cleaned Winchester out. And Margaret has a great line. Thank you, Charles. This will make Donald very happy if I tell him.
Good for her.
It's great. And then Potter hands the money he owes back to Radar. He says, here you go. And Radar starts to count it. And he says, it's okay. You can trust me. I know, sir. You say I know, but you can keep counting. I know, sir.
What's the phrase? Trust but verify.
Trust but verify. And then Mulcahy does Winchester one favor back, where he hands him a single chip from the orphans.
Yes. Oh, and the look on Charles's face.
Thank you, Father. So that leaves our three swamp rats, and they make fun of Winchester, and they say, you've been cut. What is it? He says, you're taking me to the cleaners. You know, you've been pressed and put away and folded or whatever. And Winchester, they give him a little bit of dignity where he says, Pierce, I've spent more on this than a late night snack at home. And that's great. Like, I love it. BJ says, you got to admire a guy that takes it so well. He's, I'm a Winchester, Honeycutt, a Winchester. And, I like that. I like that. It's like, yeah, for a guy with this kind of money. All right. I lost a couple $100.
Yeah,
whatever.
Drop in the bucket.
You know, big win for our doctors, our heroes. But for Winchester, it's like, nah, whatever. It's not that big of a deal. And they decide to, not pull rank, they decide to kind of pull the favor and say, well, we gave you some money. We need somebody to clean up the O Club. And Winchester goes along with it. Hawkeye and BJ walk out. And it ends, our main act break ends with Winchester singing La Traviata as he is cleaning up all the junk.
He's not singing La Traviata.
Oh, he's not? What is he singing?
No, he is singing Manana, which is the song that was playing
on
the
radio. That's right. Earlier. That's right. Yes. I'm sorry. That's correct.
So Manana is a song by written by Peggy Lee. It was the number one song in January of 1948, and it's about a family with no money.
Oh, wow. Okay. I didn't know any of that.
Yeah.
That's great. I've never known that. And in 40 years, I've been watching the great touch, Ken Levine and David Isaacs. Good job, guys. That's fantastic. That's great. I love that. I love this episode so much more, even more now.
Yeah. So that was the radio, the song playing, not Peggy Lee's version.
Right. It's sure just like an instrumental version that they're playing in the,
but that was what was playing on the radio in the O Club earlier.
Right. And Dale even says that was Manana. He even says,
And what's funny is that's what was playing when Winchester turned it off, then like a minute or two later, when they turn the radio back on, it's still the same song.
Is that the extended radio edit dance club mix or something?
Yeah. the 12-minute master cut?
Yeah. the Stairway to Heaven of 50 songs or whatever.
There you go.
But yeah, that's right. That's right. There is that gag about, you know, he even says, that. What are you doing? That was Manana. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, Hawkeye comes in. And he says, it's so quiet in here. And he turns the radio back on. So that's the end of our main episode. And then we have our button scene where BJ has got, obviously some time has passed, and he's got a little glass jar of dirt from Stinson Beach that Peg has
so
sent him.
Sweet.
And he says, I got the bottle right here with me. And he says, I can't wait to build. And there's a great gag where the whole bit about, we'll start building the first day when I get back. Okay, maybe the second day. great gag. And then he hangs up and kisses the jar of dirt, and that's the end of our episode. And I love it. I love this episode so much. It instilled something in young me that has been you know, it's been in my soul my whole life. Like I said, to the point where that's where we went on our honeymoon, for Pete's sakes. I literally went to San Francisco and the surrounding beach areas for my honeymoon. So thank you, Ken Levine and David Isaacs. Thank you, Mash Writers, for putting this little notion in the head of young me.
Well, and as I said earlier, there's not a deep meaning to this episode, but there is a moral to be learned. And it's, when you do someone a favor, don't be a jerk about it.
Yeah.
I mean, seriously, yes, collect what is due to you, but you don't need to abuse your position. If you're going to do something nice, do it to be nice, not because you can get something out of it. You know, if the loan was made with the agreement, okay, BJ, I'll do a few things for it, that would be one thing, but that wasn't part of the deal.
Yeah.
It was just Winchester abusing his quote generosity, unquote, and really uncalled for. And I don't think we see him do that again. I think he learned his lesson here.
It's a great character piece for Winchester, and it's a nice little development for BJ, you know, that, like, obviously he's got something to look forward to go home to. He's got a family, but now he's got a big, you know, life's going to move forward. You know, he's got to get their dream property. So we did not visit Stinson Beach while we were there, but now I want to go see Stinson Beach too. So I love this episode. Like, it's just fun. It's really funny. There's a bunch of great lines. We'll talk about it in a second. Our favorite line. I didn't even get to my favorite joke because there's just so many great funny lines in this. So I think it's just an absolutely terrific episode. I really love it.
A few more things I looked up in relation to this episode. We talked a little bit about the $50 earlier. So the $2,000 that, or excuse me, the $200. That BJ needs to borrow. In today's dollars, that would be $2,278, which is a really low down payment for a piece of Bay Area property. Now, I don't know, 1952, things were different. Down payments were a lot lower. So maybe that was a reasonable amount for 1952. But $2,270, that's not going to be a down payment for pretty much anywhere
that in California. In that would that would buy you a piece of property about the size of your cell phone, I would say,
and the California desert.
It's not gonna get you, not gonna get you, but the Honeycutts were in on it early, you know. They were early adopters of that area, and so good for them.
So a couple names behind the scenes that I didn't really recognize, so I looked them up. William Jurgensen, who directed it. This is one of 10 episodes he directed, but he was cinematographer on 110 episodes.
Yes, he was there. He was their main cinematographer, and then he would take an episode off and direct. Yeah.
And he was the director of photography for Walter.
That's right. That's right. the less said about that, the better. But yes, that is.
And
that
then
is,
our three writers, Ken Levine or Levine, Larry Gilbert, you know, we know those names backwards and forwards, but David Isaacs, not a name I know so well, so I looked him up. He has 37 credits as either story editor, writer, or teleplay for MASH.
Yep.
So that's not insignificant. And 13 credits for After MASH.
That's right. Both him and Levine worked on After MASH as well.
Yeah. So I just found both of those interesting. And this episode finally led me to look something up that I've always wondered about, but never wondered about enough to look up. And I finally did. What does it mean to bruise gin? So there's some question about whether it's even a real thing, but those that do believe in it say that agitating the gin breaks down the botanicals that are part of the flavor profile, and makes an inferior tasting drink as a result. So that's part of it. The other part is that shaking gin instead of stirring it aerates the liquid, and that definitely can have an effect on the flavor and the crispness of the drink.
I'll take your word for it.
I have never had a gin martini, which technically any martini is gin. At my bachelor party, I had a vodka martini, shaken, not stirred. And it was revolting.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm not a drinker. I don't drink anything. That's, you know, I was talking about Hawkeye being my hero earlier. One of the things I learned from him is to not drink. I don't drink at all.
He's your counterexample.
Yeah. It was an example of what not to do, because I like Hawkeye better when he's not drunk. And so, you know, I do use some alcohol in my cooking, but generally when you cook an alcoholic beverage, the alcohol part cooks out, boils
right.
out.
Right.
Yeah. Anyway, those just a little bit extra trivia for our listeners today.
I've had
what it means when you bruise the gin.
Again, it sounds okay. You know, I know nothing about it. I've had one martini in my life. I had it when I went on a date. many decades ago at a martini bar in Philadelphia, and I was like, well, when in Rome, let me get a martini. And I took about three sips and I'm like, this is the most foul tasting thing imaginable. And I mean, I don't drink regularly, but I drink beer occasionally. I have a glass of wine, but yeah, I was like, this is how could Hawkeye drink these? This
yeah,
is just
I honestly
worst.
Can't remember if I finished mine or not.
Oh, horrendous. It was
disgusting.
I think if I paid like $17 for it, you know what I mean? It was just, yeah, whatever, some ridiculous rate. So anyway, that was the only date I went on with this person. So anyway, Jeff, do you have a favorite line or joke from this episode?
I did. You kind of misquoted it a little bit earlier. In the first place, I don't sweat. I perspire. In the second place, I don't perspire. And that's something that will be, I don't know how often it recurs, but I do know that we get at least another episode where he says, Winchesters don't sweat, they perspire. And so that's kind of a thing with Charles being classy. So, you know, a rose by any other name, it just, you know, it sounds nicer to say perspire than sweat.
The Winchesters are genetically superior to everyone, that they don't do a normal human function, which is sweat in 100 degree heat or whatever. So okay, Charles. My favorite joke is when Hawkeye finds out at the O Club that he can't get any more drinks because he hasn't paid off his bar tab, so he won't be able to get any drinks for the foreseeable future. And I love that he turns to BJ and then he gestures at Zale and he's like, can you believe the nerve of this guy? And BJ goes, after all, you owe him. So much. I love that BJ is showing mock support for his friends. After all, you owe him. Just perfectly delivered by Mike Farrell. Makes me laugh so hard. I just love it when BJ gets a knock in on Hawkeye. Hawkeye knows he's being ridiculous, but man, it just makes me, it laughs hard. This is just a terrific episode. Absolutely terrific episode of MASH for season 6. So Jeff, thank you so much for coming by. I really appreciate it. Do you want to tell people where they can find you out on the internet?
Certainly. I'm all over Facebook. If you go to Instagram, mostly what you'll see are photos of fandom foods that I make. kind of a hobby of mine is cookbooks relating to different TV shows, movies, books, what have you. You know, for example, you know, different Star Wars cookbooks, Game of Thrones cookbook. I have a cookbook based on the Cat Who series of novels, and I make foods from them for my family. And before I serve it, I take a nice photo and post it because that's an expression of my geekiness.
Wow. Do you have the Marvel Superheroes cookbook or the,
there were a few. Now there are a lot.
Oh, really? Oh, there's multiple.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I mean, the oldest one I have was made for kids, and it's from like 78 or so. But in the past few years, there's quite a few. I have the official Black Panther cookbook. There's one.
I should have known post Marvel Universe movies.
Yeah. There's one for the Avengers campus, which is part of Disneyland. Yeah, there's a lot of different.
What a world we live in now, us nerds.
I mean, it's spectacular. I enjoy this so much. I'm actually working on a couple of cookbooks myself that I will try and get, you know, permission to get published. But if not, I'll just, you know, self-publish. One is for the BBC radio series Cabin Pressure. It's kind of where Benedict Cumberbatch got his start.
I've heard of that show. Yes.
Yeah, I love it. And then The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy does not have a cookbook based on that series. So I'm doing, in what I left of the call my spare time, I'm making a cookbook based on the foods mentioned primarily in the novels. But if there's something different in the movie versions or the radio versions, I'll do something for those too. I used to be a more regular podcaster. I even have a podcast network of my own, www.podcastcadia.com. You can find links to all the podcasts that I did under that. There's a podcast about the tabletop game HeroClix. There's the Unpracticed Disorganized Acting Company, which is where I would get a bunch of people together and hand them scripts and assign random roles. So like an episode of Firefly, we'd sit down, I would randomly assign the roles, and we'd do a cold reading. And then I would put it out as a podcast.
My goodness. Busy man.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
I so appreciate you having me. I love listening to most of your shows. I don't listen to Pod Dylan because I'm not a Bob Dylan fan. Sorry, Rob.
It's really okay. He's got enough fans. It's all right, Jeff. It's okay. Really fine. I think Bob will get over it. I appreciate you coming on. It was great to have you on the podcast. And of course, everybody, you can find all the back episodes of the show on our website, FrankWaterPodcast.com. You can subscribe to the show on any podcatcher of your choice. We're always talking MASH over on Twitter at MASH477Cast. And then finally, if you want to support FrankWater Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW Podcast. And there you can unlock various rewards, one of which to be name checked on a show of your choice. So a big salute to Daniel Ulrich, Nicholas Prom, Russell Burbage, Dan Peel, Mike Thomas, Joe Perino, Billy Shulman, Dennis Bailey, Kara Kay, Tim English, Adam Ackerman, Lisa P., Laura Braun, Stefan Van Skyke, Michael Kelly, and Daryl Clark. Thank you so much for the support. So we will see you later, but until then, that is all.
Yeah, I've got the bottle of dirt right here with me. It's just like I remembered it. We'll start building the day I get home. Okay, the second day.